From the Voice of America in Washington, welcome. This is VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman.
Hi, Ira Melman, and we took away the mannequin, by the way. I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, a deadly attack on a Tripoli, Libya hotel popular with politicians and international workers.
President Obama says the United States can become India's best partner as he concludes a three-day visit to New Delhi.
China Focus examines concern about China by both India and the United States.
On today's report on education, we take a look at opposition to Confucius Institutes at U.S. colleges.
In the American Cafe, the attempt by Washington, D.C. to deal with the problem of graffiti.
And David Byrd takes a well-rounded look at the artist Peter Paul Rubens.
We'll check business and sports as well. All this coming up on today's edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America. Glad you could join us for Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asian news and events for Wednesday, January 28th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, President Barack Obama says India and the United States are not just natural partners, but that America can be India's best partner. The president capped his historic trip to India with a speech calling on both nations to come together to fight poverty, climate change, and intolerance. VOA correspondent Arup Pandey is traveling with the president and has more from New Delhi.
After nearly 3 days of wooing India's prime minister and business leaders, President Obama took his message of a new chapter in U.S.-India relations directly to the Indian people on Tuesday.
I'm here because I'm absolutely convinced that both our peoples will have more jobs and opportunity, and our nations will be more secure, and the world will be safer and a more just place when our two democracies, the world's largest democracy and the world's oldest democracy, stand together.
He made the comments a day after becoming the first U.S. president to take part in India's Republic Day celebration as chief guest, speaking to an audience of 1,500 people in New Delhi's Sri Fort Tuesday. Mr. Obama said together, the United States and India can improve the lives of their people and reduce poverty through increased trade and investment in infrastructure and renewable energy. The U.S. president added that in order to be true global partners, both nations must confront and lead the effort to fight climate change. The United States and India are the world's largest polluters after China, and during talks Sunday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said he is ready to work with President Obama towards a global deal to cut emissions during the December United Nations Climate Summit. President Obama invoked the deadly 2012 shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin and quoted Mahatma Gandhi's words that the different religions are beautiful flowers from the same garden. With those remarks, the president concluded his trip to India and left for Saudi Arabia to pay his respects to the family of late King Abdullah. Arup Pandey, VOA News, New Delhi.
Increasing counterterrorism and border security cooperation between Pakistan and Afghanistan has raised hopes for more effective anti-drug regional efforts. We hear now from Ayaz Ghul from Islamabad.
Despite significant international investment to counter illicit drug production in Afghanistan, a recent UN survey says the country has seen a surge in poppy cultivation area for a third consecutive year. Pakistani authorities say the increase in Afghan drugs coupled with the withdrawal of the bulk of NATO forces from the war-shattered country poses even a bigger challenge to their counter-narcotics efforts. Pakistan Anti-Narcotics Force head Major General Khawar Hanif told a UN-sponsored international conference in Islamabad, continued international involvement is needed to tackle the Afghan drug problem.
Thankfully, the commitment of the present Afghan government with respect to border control arrangements and counter-narcotic efforts is quite palpable. However, we believe that unless there is a wholehearted support from the international community proportionate to the drug problem, the region is going to remain in the same crisis. Abandoning our Afghan colleagues to deal with this overwhelming poppy cultivation and drug production is not an option at all.
Pakistan shares a 2,500-kilometer, mostly porous border with Afghanistan. General Hanif says the terrain poses challenges to the country's fight against terrorism and drugs trafficking.
A lot of divided villages, as you can see on the borders, facilitate in movement across the border both ways. And you actually enter into a village from one country and get out in the other. There are more than 200 unfrequented routes in which practically there are no law enforcement agencies present.
Pakistan and Afghanistan have exchanged high-level military delegations as part of joint efforts to enhance security and deal with militants involved in attacks on both sides of the border. A delegation of Afghan border police is in Pakistan for talks with senior security officials. Pakistani officials say the proliferation of Afghan drugs has also led to an increase in drug addiction in Pakistan. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Thailand is reporting progress in efforts to curb human trafficking and abusive labor practices for migrant workers. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok on what steps the government is taking after coming under criticism from rights groups and the United States.
In 2014, the United States lowered Thailand's rating in its Trafficking in Persons report in an assessment that the country showed few signs of improving its record on human trafficking and illegal labor. In a wide range of Thai industries, from fishing vessels, factories and farms, rights groups have complained that many foreign workers are exploited, paid very little, and expected to work long hours under threats of violence. The US downgrade placed Thailand on the lowest ranking, Tier 3, leaving the country open to non-trade and non-humanitarian sanctions, as well as the withholding of assistance from international financial institutions such as the World Bank. Thailand has a migrant worker population estimated at up to 3 million people, mostly undocumented workers from Burma, as well as Cambodia, Laos and Vietnam. The US report said victims of human trafficking, often subject to forced labor and the sex trade, also included people from China, Russia, Uzbekistan, India and Fiji. Last year, Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha called for the creation of special committees to oversee the creation of new policies to crack down on trafficking and improve worker rights in a range of industries. This week, the Thai Foreign Ministry released an interim report on the government's tougher legislation and new anti-trafficking measures. Thai Deputy Foreign Minister Don Pramud Winay told a news conference he believed the initiatives marked progress in addressing the issues of human trafficking.
The six past 6 months, there were tangible results, whether it's amendments of law and all the issues pertaining to the victims and the enforcement as well. All these genuine measures are going to be implemented in a very effective manner.
Measures include tougher legislations to protect labour in the fishing industry, including raising the minimum wage for workers to 18 years and ensuring each has a labour contract. In the agricultural sector, the age has been increased to 15. The Thai government says the efforts to curb human trafficking are being given a top priority. A report summary of the government's policies is to be forwarded to the US State Department later this month. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Stop by voanews.com. There you'll find longer versions of these stories, some with photos and video. And while you're there, subscribe to Daybreak Asia's podcast.
This is VOA Global with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. It's time for our audience feedback section. We've been talking a lot today about President Barack Obama's visit to India, where he said the United States and India are not just natural partners, but that America can be India's best partner. Willie Webb from Phoenix, Arizona, here in the United States, says climate change, intolerance, they should be fighting for nuclear power plants and against terrorism. Democratically elected government should be fighting for what the people want and need, what they were elected for, not pie-in-the-sky ideals.
Also on our website, the UN emergency aid drops for North Korea. Crises in other parts of the world are causing the United Nations to lower emergency relief aid to North Korea this year. One World Now from Earth writes to us and says, should stop the aid period. For what? They hate us. No matter what we do for the Koreans, they hate us. Even the South Koreans aren't nice toward Americans. Get out and let them have their war. May the best kimchi muncher win. That's his opinion.
Okay. The Observer from Canada says all UN aid should be handed directly to civilians of North Korea, not to the hands of the North Korean army. Confusion. Optimism remains as Vietnam criminalizes gay marriage. Beck from Vietnam says, Vietnam, you're growing up in good ways. Keep on growing.
And deadly clashes break out between Muslim rebels and Philippine police. Philippine authorities saying the death toll was over 40 in a fight between special police raiding teams and members of the country's largest Muslim rebel group. Hank Rockwell Jr. writes, Islamic extremists must not be tolerated in any way, shape, or form. They must either succumb to the rule of law or perish. You can write to us on our website. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. And in addition to getting in touch with us on our website, Facebook, Twitter, Weibo. There's another way.
Tell me.
You can write to us via email, voaasia@voanews.com.
That's so passe.
I know, but it works.
I guess it does.
So we invite you to do that. Whatever's on your mind, write to us.
Coming up, we have a couple of features you might like. I can't find them. Here they are. I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. U.S. lawmakers are investigating whether academic freedom is being threatened at American universities building campuses in China and partnering with the Chinese on Confucius Institutes. The chairman of a House subcommittee focusing on human rights said that he will seek a governmental accountability office study of agreements between U.S. universities and China that allow China to promote its culture and language here through education programs it supervises and finances. This past summer, I talked with some people involved in the conversation. The move against the Chinese-sponsored institute system stems at least in part from a magazine article written by Marshall Salins, professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of Chicago. Salins told us that in addition to teaching the Chinese language and culture as espoused in its literature, the Confucius Institutes are also interested in power. He terms it soft power.
And it's under the control of an organization in China called Hanban, which itself is under the governance of a governing council that consists of a chair who's a head, a chair who's a member of the Politburo, and vice chairs who will hold important ministries and high official positions in the government, which checks the annual agenda of the Confucius Institute and receives the reports.
Salins contends the delivery of this agenda are the Confucius teachers who are selected, paid, and placed in the institutes by Hanban.
Teachers are sent out by Hanban, selected according to Hanban criteria, which includes a requirement of so-called political thinking, which is to say that the teachers have to be vetted according to Chinese rules about political correctness.
Which Salin says includes steering clear of conversations about prohibited topics such as Tibet, the Dalai Lama, and Tiananmen Square. Salin says many of the textbooks, also supplied by China, are less than objective, with one of the history texts detailing how U.S. aggression started the war in Korea. One of the oldest Confucius Institutes is on the campus of the University of Maryland.
I've just not seen some of the things that other people are talking about. And it could be that it's because we have negotiated and we have grown and we have changed it in ways that match what we want to accomplish on our campus.
Donna Weissman is the director of the Confucius Institute at the University of Maryland, as well as being the dean of that school's College of Education.
Hanban in China has established a program for campuses across the world, not just in the United States and Canada, but across the world, to really promote Chinese language learning and also culture. understanding of culture, and they really do have a very narrow focus of language learning and culture.
As is most often the case when dealing with controversial issues, there is a middle ground. Terry Bogalke directs the education program at Hawaii's East-West Institute.
I think that, by and large, that they're doing some good work in providing opportunity for Chinese language study. On the other hand, I think that there isn't the kind of openness in exploring cultural, social kinds of issues. I think reflecting, in many respects, the reluctance of the Chinese government to perhaps open issues that could become controversial.
I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. You can hear the reports on air and online at voanews.com and various podcast platforms.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. U.S. President Barack Obama concluded his visit to India Tuesday, saying he believes the United States can become India's best partner. A key concern of Mr. Obama and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is China, as Beijing expands its economy and military. Anubhav Gupta is a senior program officer for the Asia Society Policy Institute. He tells me about Washington and New Delhi's worries about China.
I would say it's a huge concern, and it's, I think, an issue of mutual ambivalence for both countries, where both countries want a very strong and positive relationship with China. They are both large trading partners with China, and so there's an economic relationship there. But at the same time, there are certain issues that both countries face where there is some kind of conflict with China. One of them, which was actually mentioned quite in some ways shockingly during the visit, Obama's visit in India, was the South China Sea issue. The two countries agreed to a joint strategic vision for the Asia Pacific and Indian Ocean region. And in that vision, the two leaders specifically mentioned the South China Sea, talking about ensuring maritime security and ensuring freedom of navigation and overflight in that region. So the fact that China is now getting specific mention from both countries in public documents is a new step, I think, in the relationship.
How is India impacted by what some see as China's expansionist tendencies?
Well, India is very concerned about China's expansionist policies, that if it perceives them that way. And that's because India has fought a war with China over border disputes. That war was in 1962, and it proved to be one of India's more embarrassing military engagements since its independence. And Indians still to this day think of the 1962 war that has not really gotten out of people's minds when they think about China. And India continues to have two different sets of borders that are under dispute with China. And so as India observes how China deals with its other border disputes, especially in the South China Seas, it wonders, will China act in a similar way vis-a-vis border disputes in India? So I think for that reason, India wants to ensure that China deals with its border disputes in a peaceful way, in a way that corresponds with international negotiations, international law. And for that reason, India watches what China does on these issues very carefully.
Well, and I guess that would also include perhaps the Bay of Bengal.
Yes. So this past year, there was some alarm in the Indian defense establishment because Chinese nuclear submarines were found close to the Bay of Bengal. And that raised important concerns about India's nuclear deterrence and in general about what India needs to do militarily to try to essentially be able to compete and deter any Chinese aggression. And again, both countries have maintained a strong diplomatic engagement. Both countries prefer a friendship and a relationship that values economic partnerships over these disputes. But because the border disputes exist, because India has started to, in recent years, act a little bit more robustly and has been a little more engaged towards Southeast Asia, for that reason, I think both countries view each other with a little bit of suspicion.
Do you think some of this has been encouraged by the new prime minister, by Mr. Modi?
I'm not sure whether it's been encouraged. I think a lot of people had actually thought that Prime Minister Modi would try to improve relations with China. When he was the chief minister of the Indian state of Gujarat, he went to China. He seemed to view China in a positive light. At the same time, I think his political capital and his political power at the moment over Indian politics has allowed him to perhaps say things that other leaders in the past have been reluctant to say. And I can also think that perhaps his view on this might have changed. In September, when President Xi Jinping visited India, that was a visit that Prime Minister Modi, I think, was hoping to be a trip that helped to start to build a more positive relationship between the two countries. Both leaders are somewhat new to power, and so that was an opportunity. But I think Prime Minister Modi was disappointed, and it's been reported that he was even perhaps angered when that trip was overshadowed when Chinese troops and Indian troops had a border standoff, and that ended up really overshadowing the entire trip.
Anubhav Gupta, Senior Program Officer for the Asia Society Policy Institute. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
Let's check Asia business news on VOA Global with Jim Stevens and I'm Ira Melman. Chinese stocks broke a five-day winning streak Tuesday as Hong Kong and Shanghai markets both pulled back amid concerns fueled by a drop in the profit growth at major Chinese industrial companies and a previous sharp fall for China's yuan. At the same time, Japanese stocks advanced to one-month highs after Greek election results impacted global markets by less than expected on Monday. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index retreated to 24,897 after touching a four-month high on the previous close. On the mainland, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 0.9% to 33.53, also pulling back from its best closing level in more than 5 years. The declines came after official data showing that profit at major Chinese industrial companies grew 3.3% year-on-year in 2014, down sharply from the 12.2% increase in 2013. A significant drop in China's yuan in the previous day also dented investor sentiment. However, other Asian markets were stronger. Japan's Nikkei average added 1.7% to 17,768.
Well, for the first time, all varieties of apples from the United States will be going on sale in China. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a deal was reached last week between officials for the United States and Chinese governments to grant access to all U.S. apple varieties instead of just Red Delicious and Golden Delicious. The Washington Apple Commission, which represents growers of the nation's largest crop and most apple exports, said China stopped buying U.S. apples in 2012 because of concerns over a fungus. Access for Red Delicious and Golden Delicious apples was regained in October. An agreement reached last week in San Francisco will open for the first time the door to all varieties in coming weeks. Nice to hear. That's Asia Business News on VOA.
This is Today in History. On January 28, 814, Charlemagne, also known as Charles the Great, King of the Franks, died. Charlemagne attempted to bring order and stability to Europe through a series of conquests and reforms. On this day in 1521, the Diet of Worms began. The deliberative assembly of the Holy Roman Empire met to consider what to do about the Protestant Reformation. On this day in 1596, Sir Francis Drake, privateer and first Englishman to circumnavigate the world, died off the coast of Spanish-held Puerto Rico. On this day in 1871, Prussian forces converged on Paris during the Franco-Prussian War, laying siege to the French capital for more than 4 months until the French agreed to surrender. On January 28, 1986, the U.S. Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Here on VOA Global, around this country, especially the eastern part of this country, there has been a major snowstorm. Here in Washington, we were predicted to get a pretty bad blizzard, but it turned out to be okay.
Not bad at all.
But in the northeastern part of the United States, including Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, major blizzard.
Right. They had a video released Monday ahead of the big storm. Matt Glendening sang the announcement to students at Moses Brown School in Rhode Island to the tune of the movie's best-known song, Let It Go. Ugh. That was creative.
Yes. Had to do something.
The video, they go like, let it go, let it go. Oh, that's a different song.
Yeah, that's exactly the wrong one. However, it worked, and I guess the kids were happy not only to hear the sound, but they had a day off shoveling snow.
They didn't go to school, that's for sure.
For sure.
Latest World News is next with Michael Lippin.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, an attack on a hotel in Libya's capital kills five foreigners. An international diplomat says Syria's president favors a political solution to the Syrian civil war. And U.S. President Obama leads a U.S. delegation paying respects to the late Saudi king. I'm Michael Lippin. Libyan authorities say an attack on a Tripoli hotel popular with politicians and international workers has killed five foreigners and three guards. Security officials at the Carinthia Hotel said assailants stormed the building on Tuesday after blowing up their vehicle and shooting staff members. It was not immediately clear who carried out the attack, but a group identifying itself as the Tripoli Province of the Islamic State claimed responsibility in an online statement. The Carinthia is the hotel from which kidnappers briefly abducted former Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zidane in 2013. Libya is struggling for stability after more than three years after the ouster of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, with multiple groups trying to assert control. The Islamic State militant group has threatened to kill two foreign hostages by Wednesday if its demands for a prisoner exchange are not met. In an online video message attributed to the group on Tuesday, the militants repeated a demand for Jordan to free a woman detained for involvement in a 2005 terror attack that killed 60 people in the Jordanian capital, Amman. The hostages, Japanese journalist Kenji Goto and Jordanian pilot Muath Al-Kasa Azabeh, are believed to be in Islamic State custody. Japan has requested help from Jordan to secure Goto's release. In northern Syria, Kurdish fighters say they have widened their offensive against Islamic State strongholds near the embattled town of Kobani. The Kurds say they took control of a neighboring village on Tuesday, a day after claiming the recapture of Kobani, which is located along the Turkish border. American officials have said the U.S.-allied Kurdish fighters have taken control of about 90% of Kobani after 4 months of conflict with the Islamic State, which had tried to seize the town. The head of the Inter-Parliamentary Union says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad appears to believe that a political settlement is the only way to end the four-year-old conflict in his country. Lisa Schlein has the story from Geneva.
Inter-Parliamentary Union Secretary General Martin Chungong just returned from holding extensive talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He is quick to say he did not go to Syria to legitimize the regime or to support any party to the conflict. In the course of discussions, he says it became clear President Assad does not see a military solution to the conflict.
And I think that he is increasingly confident that the international community does not seem to think that a solution to the Syrian crisis would be his immediate departure. I think that from that point of view, he feels a bit more secure.
The civil war in Syria has killed more than 200,000 people, and nearly 10 million have become internally displaced or refugees in neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A former top commander of Somalia's al-Shabaab terror group says he has quit the insurgency, renouncing the violence perpetuated by his former comrades. Zakaria Ismail Hirsi served as intelligence chief of the al-Qaeda-linked organization before surrendering to Somali authorities last December. Speaking at a news conference in Mogadishu on Tuesday, he said that from now on he will convey his principles and beliefs through peaceful means and understanding. In June 2012, the U.S. offered a $3 million reward for Hirsi's capture, describing him as an associate of former al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Abdi Godane. About 300 survivors of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi concentration camp gathered Tuesday at the site in Poland to pay their respects to victims who perished in gas chambers or from inhumane treatment and disease. When the Nazi death camp was liberated on January 27, 1945, by the Soviet Army, soldiers found 7,000 prisoners, among them 130 children. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Monday it was a disgrace that Jews in Germany faced insults, threats, and violence. Merkel joined survivors in a commemorative ceremony marking the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the most notorious Nazi death camps of World War II. Ukraine's parliament has approved a statement labeling Russia as an aggressor state. Ukrainian legislators also voted on Tuesday to designate the self-proclaimed republics of Russian-backed Ukrainian separatists as terrorist organizations. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Grigory Karsen criticized the Ukrainian parliament's move, saying it was absolutely irresponsible and aimed at blocking movement toward a much-needed compromise in Ukraine. Well, U.S. President Barack Obama traveled to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to pay his respects following last week's death of 90-year-old Saudi King Abdullah. Mr. Obama made a brief stop in the capital Riyadh while leading a 30-member U.S. delegation that included officials and lawmakers, as well as senior officials from previous presidential administrations. While in Riyadh, President Obama met for the first time with the new Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz before departing the country. Well, during a U.S. congressional hearing on Tuesday, Democratic U.S. Senator Robert Menendez said he will hold off on pushing his own bill to impose additional sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program until after March 24th, an interim deadline in international talks with Iran. VOA's Cindy Sain has more from Capitol Hill.
Menendez surprised many by making this announcement at Tuesday's Senate Banking Committee hearing on Iran.
Many of my Democratic colleagues and I have sent a letter to the president telling him that we will not support passage of the Kirk-Menendez bill on the Senate floor until after March 24th, and only if there is no political framework agreement, because, as the letter states, we remain hopeful that diplomacy will succeed in reversing Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon capability.
Menendez did make clear that he is still skeptical that Iran truly wants to reach a deal. Speaking for the Obama administration, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken again made a strong appeal for Congress to hold off any planned votes on additional sanctions. Blinken said a vote on additional sanctions could make U.S. allies think that Washington is not serious about reaching an agreement and give hardliners in Iran an excuse to pull out of the talks. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
A massive winter storm dropped up to 60 centimeters of snow in some parts of the northeastern U.S. on Monday and Tuesday, but fell short of forecasters' worst predictions, especially in New York City. Massachusetts and Connecticut saw some of the heaviest snow. Well, that's it for International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for joining us.
This is Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. stocks recorded their biggest decline in 3 weeks on Tuesday following a surprise drop in durable goods orders and disappointing earnings from bellwethers such as Microsoft Corporation and Caterpillar. The weak data stoked fears that economic growth is decelerating. The S&P 500 was off 1.3% to close at 2029. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1.7% to finish at 17,387. The NASDAQ Composite ended the day with a loss of nearly 2%. It closed at 4,681.
Shares of Yahoo surged 8% in after-hours trading Tuesday after the internet company disclosed it plans to monetize the stake it still owns in the Chinese e-commerce behemoth Alibaba. Yahoo said it plans to spin off its 384 million share stake in Alibaba into a separate publicly traded company named SpinCo.
The Obama administration floated a plan Tuesday that for the first time would open up a broad swath of the Atlantic coast to drilling, even as it moved to restrict drilling in environmentally sensitive areas off Alaska. The proposal envisions auctioning areas located more than 50 miles off Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia to oil companies about 2021, long after President Obama leaves office. And for decades, oil companies have been barred from drilling in the Atlantic Ocean, where a moratorium was in place until 2008.
U.S. consumers welcome the new year with a surge in confidence. The Conference Board reported Tuesday that its Consumer Confidence Index climbed this month to 102.9, having the highest level since August of 2007. There you have it, a look at international business news from the Voice of America. Coming up on VOA Global... You ever hear anybody call something Rubenesque?
Yeah, you know, if they're a little bit round, shall we say.
Yeah, well, that all stems from a Flemish, as people, some people will say, the Flemish artist.
I hope you're feeling better.
Rubens, and David Byrd will have that coming up on his Now, and that's just a few minutes from now, right here on VOA Global. Stay with us. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Like many cities, Washington, D.C. has a graffiti problem. Walls and the sides of buildings, especially in low-income neighborhoods, are often defaced by this illegal form of artistic expression. But as we hear from VOA's Julie Tabo, officials in the nation's capital have come up with an innovative program that uses the talents of local artists to beautify the city.
There you go. There you go.
About a dozen young artists have gathered at a workshop in downtown Washington to learn how to use spray paint to make graffiti that beautifies rather than defaces. Michelle Chen is one of the workshop participants.
So at first, you know, it seemed like a very sort of crude instrument, but just being able to see what artists are able to do with it, it's really amazing.
They practice on small walls with Eric Ricks, a graffiti artist from Liberia who used to paint on buildings illegally, but who's now getting paid by the city to share his talent with aspiring young artists.
It's one of those things I love to share and to see young people pick it up with the passion that I myself had, because I feel like I'm a big kid just as much as any one of them.
The workshop is part of a program called Murals DC that city officials have created to overcome their graffiti problem. After 10 weeks of training, most of the students join Ricks in a neighborhood in the north of the city to create a vibrant mural on a wall which was once defaced with graffiti. The mural is just one of 50 the city has commissioned since the program began in 2007. Artist Aniakan Udofia recently completed his 8th mural for the city for a public aquatic center. The artist has taught a number of graffiti workshops, which he says has been a rewarding experience.
Instead of defacing property, what we do is I show them how they can collaborate with artists like myself and create something that not only they can get paid for, but they can also get praised for.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
While many teenagers spend their summers relaxing, a group of young people in the small rural town of Bedford, Virginia, is learning to be global ambassadors. They're attending a 12-day Global Youth Village summer camp sponsored by Legacy International. They discover the customs as well as the hardships of their peers and discuss ways to build peace and protect human rights. Now in its 35th year, the program has hosted 4,000 teenagers from 100 countries. VOA's Deborah Block visited the camp and followed a Ghanaian teenager on his journey.
Kofi Jirwa is teaching a Ghanaian dance to his new friends. The 22 teenagers from 15 to 18 years old are from a variety of countries, including China, Eritrea, Libya, Poland, and the United States.
Meeting all these different people, I realized that we have a lot of differences in cultures, but we also have a lot of similarities.
As part of the Global Youth Village experience in this rural area, Kofi is sharing a cabin with other boys.
They're kind of like my brothers. We've bonded. We've done a lot of stupid things. It's pretty homey. I feel right at home.
Arts instructor Tony Santa Anna says the goal is to create global citizens who can make the world a better place.
This idea of through arts, through games, through laughing, through dancing, they're able to create this harmonious, peaceful village.
Kofi taps into his creative side during an art class.
Every day I've done something different, so all the designs are different and unique in their own way.
And challenges himself by writing his first ever poem.
I see the flames of discrimination burn through the flesh of its victims as it reduces them to nothing but cinder. I am an ember of oppression, for I too have discriminated against, whether intentionally or not.
Kofi says he and the other students are breaking down stereotypes. He says the lessons he takes home will last a lifetime and make him a better leader. Deborah Block, VOA News, Bedford, Virginia.
Join us in the American Cafe daily at voanews.com and as a podcast. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Have you ever heard the phrase Rubenesque? Well, if you call somebody that, they might think you're calling them fat. But a new exhibit in London's Royal Gallery hopes to show the wide-ranging influence the 17th-century Flemish painter Peter Paul Rubens had on art, even to the modern day. The exhibit, called Rubens and His Legacy, aims to prove that Rubens's influence was far beyond plump nymphs and cherubs or paintings that featured round, fleshy people, particularly nude women. Viewers see both Rubens' works and those of other artists, including his pupil Antony van Dyck. Nico van Hout from the Royal Museum of Fine Arts in Antwerp, Belgium, is the exhibit's curator.
We underestimate usually Rubens and maybe overestimate some other artists. I think many major artists such as Rembrandt, Watteau, Gainsborough, Reynolds, Constable, they all were looking at Rubens, and not without a reason.
The exhibit is arranged thematically, with viewers moving from galleries that emphasize poetry to portraiture, religion, violence, and even lust. Each gives the viewers the chance to see Rubens' work and that of those who followed and even subconsciously imitated him. The exhibit features some of the Flemish master's most famous works, including the visceral Tiger, Lion, and Leopard Hunt, in which a tiger pulls an ill-fated horseman from his muscular mount, while another man holds open the mouth of a lion in the battle to the death. Curator Nico van Hout says that Rubens possessed a unique talent for showing movement in two dimensions, and his gift for portraying human flesh influenced artists for generations.
His vitality is, in fact, the result from blurred contours, contours that are not very sharply drawn, mainly in his later work. And that was so inspiring for many artists. So how to depict movement on a flat image and not cinema, yeah, it's a difficult thing. So you can do that through this trick of using blurred contours.
Visitors also get to see some of Rubens' mythological and religious scenes, including the famous Pan and Syrinx, where the lustful satyr pursues the nymph beside the river Ladon. She struggles through reeds, into which she soon will be turned. Art critic Estelle Lovett, a fellow of the Royal Art Society, told the AP that looking at Rubens' paintings is almost like watching a film, even though they predate film by hundreds of years.
The way that he tells the story, the way that looking at his paintings, because there's such movement, it's almost like they're cinematic. It's almost as though his canvases are moving, like going to the cinema. It's like watching a movie when you look at a Rubens painting.
Many painters studied Rubens' works, hoping to produce the subtle flesh tones that he achieved. But Estelle Lovett says the Flemish master's ability to capture nudes cannot be taken for granted.
It's this fleshy, squeezy, you know, I'd love, of course you can't, to be able to scrape back some of the oil paint. I'm sure it's pulsating as the flesh does.
Curator Nico van Hout told the AP that while Rubens influenced many painters, he also drew from a deep tradition that included Leonardo da Vinci, Titian, and Michelangelo.
He took from everybody, but he transformed it into his own idiom, and so that nowadays you can easily always say, oh, that's Rubens. But in it, there is perhaps an influence by Titian or by Michelangelo or by any other Italian artist. But you never, it's never obvious. So you always have to detach it and discover it into that work.
Rubens has been known for his use of colors, his dynamism, and his vitality. But the exhibit shows how his influence reached beyond his life and affected Romanticism, Impressionism, and even modern film. To see some of the paintings, log on to www.royalacademy.org.uk and look for the exhibit title. So what do you think? Do you have a favorite artist? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
A bit of a fish story out of Northern Ireland. The Belfast City Council is advising its citizens not to eat fish lying on the roadside. It's a great advisory.
You have to know a little bit more. Thousands of mackerel were dumped onto the roadway, Ravenhill Road in Northern Ireland, apparently by a delivery truck with a loose back door. And one of the guys said, wait a minute, this isn't fishy. He said, I know fish. 61-year-old Tommy Barsley said he bagged 25 of the mackerel. Why not eat it?
Yum.
Time for sports on VOA Global. Rafael Nadal kept telling anyone who would listen that his fitness levels wouldn't stand up to the rigors of a two-week Grand Slam tournament. Thomas Berdych proved him right. Nadal, who had played only 8 matches since last June coming into the Australian Open because of a right wrist injury and appendix surgery in early November, was knocked out in the quarterfinals 6-2, 6-love, 7-6 on Tuesday by Berdych, who had lost 17 straight matches to the Spaniard. The other men's semifinalist will be determined Wednesday when top seed Novak Djokovic plays Milos Raonic, and and defending champion Stan Wawrinka takes on U.S. Open runner-up Kai Nishikori.
Well, there is play on the women's side as well. Maria Sharapova moving closer to another Australian Open title. She defeated 20-year-old Eugene Bouchard 6-3, 6-2 to advance to play Ekaterina Makarova, who earlier beat third-seeded Simona Halep 6-4, 6-love. The other women's semifinalists to be determined Wednesday as number one ranked Serena Williams plays last year's finalist Dominika Sibulkova and Venus Williams playing in her first Grand Slam quarter in nearly 5 years. She takes on tender 19-year-old aged American Madison Keys.
Now, if the Williams sisters do play each other in the semifinals, it would be their first meeting in a Grand Slam tournament since the Wimbledon final in 2009. Serena won that.
That could be exciting.
Yes, it could.
The IOC, meanwhile, has dismissed a suggestion by a Saudi Arabian official that the ultra-conservative nation could seek to co-host the Olympics with neighboring Bahrain and hold the men's and women's events in separate countries. Prince Fahad bin Jalawi Al Saud, an international relations consultant to the president of the Saudi Arabian Olympic Committee, told the French Olympic website that resolutions passed by the IOC last month opened the door for a potential joint bid with men's events on Saudi territory, women's competitions in Bahrain.
Well, in the NBA, Kobe Bryant will have surgery Wednesday on his torn right rotator cuff, likely ending his 19th season with the Los Angeles Lakers. That is a look at sports here on VOA Global. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman.
The Izod Center at the New Jersey Meadowlands just outside of New York City has fallen on hard times after the former National Basketball Association's Nets moved to Brooklyn a couple of years ago. Sports authority officials there say the facility is facing $8.5 million in losses this year, not good, and they had no choice but to shut it down in the face of increasing subsidies from the state of New Jersey. And that threw into doubt the fate of a couple of concerts scheduled for March. Promoters, however, say Maroon 5 will indeed take the stage for the venue's final scheduled concert, March 8th. To sweeten the otherwise bittersweet demise of the Izod Center, here's Maroon 5 with Sugar.
Thank you. want that sugar sweet. Don't let nobody touch it unless that somebody's me. I gotta be a man, there ain't no other way. Cause girl, you're hotter than a Southern California day. I don't wanna play no games, you don't gotta be afraid. Don't give me all that shy sh- no makeup.
Maroon 5 and Sugar. Interesting story here. If you see the video of this from their new album 5, it takes place at a lot of weddings. Well, what they did is that they just, the whole group, just dropped in on weddings around the Los Angeles area with cameras and just barged their way in, and they performed, much to the delight of the people, but then they put it all together, and that is the video of Maroon 5 and Sugar.
Pakistan team management, cricket that is, says one of their players, Harris Sohail, was left visibly shaken after a ghostly encounter in a Christchurch hotel room. Sohail fled what he believed was a supernatural presence which shook his bed at the Ridges Latimer Hotel. He took refuge in the room of a team coach after the encounter earlier this week.
Yeah, team manager Mavid Akram Chiva said Tuesday that the 26-year-old Sohail phoned a member of the coaching staff to say he had been woken by his bed being shaken. Coach rushed to Sohail's room and found him shaken and feverish. Chiva said management tried to persuade him that his fever may have caused a nightmare, but the player was adamant his experience was supernatural.
Maybe it was one of those beds that you put the quarters in. You think maybe one of his teammates played
magic,
a trick on him?
Magic fingers. Yeah. But, you know, the thing was when he got out of the bed, I don't know if you saw the movie Exorcist, and he started, like Linda
Creepy.
Blair did, turn his head around with 360 degrees. The hotel management says it knows of no active ghost on the premises. However,
passive ghost, maybe, but not active.
You want to know how many people in Christchurch are going to go in and ask for Sohail's room or not?
You know, apparently this isn't the first time. I mean, they say there's an elite group of international cricketers who have had ghostly experiences. Maybe that came after bad losses
or
something.
We hope you don't have a ghostly experience on this program tonight. How's that for a
good
segue?
I like that.
Tracy Carter was our director, still is. Carol Starling is pushing our buttons. Well, he was anyway.
Jimmy Cook too.
Yeah, Jimmy Cook there. And Diane Gao is our executive person, producer, director, in charge of everything. Have a great day, everybody.
Bye.